Today on Hear Us Out, we're joined by Maya Sulkin, a thoughtful, fearless storyteller whose work at the Free Press has helped shape some of the most important conversations happening today. Maya has a gift for finding the human heart inside every story, for listening deeply, and for asking the questions that make us think a little harder about the world around us. We'll explore her journey into journalism, the stories that have stayed with her, and how sound, the literal kind and the emotional kind, shapes the way we tell and hear the truth. So settle in, because this conversation isn't just about the news, it's about how we truly listen. Maya, welcome to Hear Us Out.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Our pleasure.
Excited to have you.
Why don't we start out, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with the Free Press and the work of the Free Press, why don't you tell us a little bit about the organization?
Yeah, so the Free Press is a media company. It's founded by Barry Weiss, who kind of infamously left the New York Times very publicly. And I would say the thing that makes us different is that our slogan or tagline is think for yourself. And so we really pride ourselves on having a really truly diverse, I mean that in the real sense of the term, sense of opinions. And we cover breaking news stories. And I think our, kind of unique selling point is kind of sense making. And so in the world of Twitter and commodity news, the value to a reader is not necessarily always being first, but helping them make sense of what this really means for them. Something we always think about is, like, we know the reader is really busy, spend time like we do all day reading the news or online. And so it's like, how does, a mom with three kids who's a doctor or a banker or whatever, make sense of the news so she can make informed decisions about where to send her kids, what to feed them, really everything under the sun. And I think, it is a startup, it's a new media company, but we've kind of found this place, kind of this bridge between, like, the old world and the new world of media. And so I see that as, like, people go to the New York Times for a reason, and that's because the institution comes with guardrails against, like, they have fact checkers, they have an art team. And so we have those things that make the experience trustworthy and enjoyable, but we're not bound to the kind of ideological thinking, but we're also not Joe Rogan. Like, we have, it's like capital J journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of where I would place us on a kind of media map for new people.
Specifically drew you to journalism in the first place?
So funny, I was just talking about this with a colleague. I never really was certain that I even wanted to be a journalist. I kind of came across the Free Press when I was in college, and I was having a pretty hard time just, it was, like, politically extremely tense. My courses were extremely ideological. The social and political had really no separation. And a lot of what Barry had written about, she went to the same college as me, was about dealing with that. And even we had some of the same professors and were, over 15 years apart, that kind of created this culture. And so I basically just wrote her a cold email back when it was called Common Sense. It was, like, more of her personal blog. I wrote her a cold email. And from there, I, was an intern, and then I was offered a job intern. But I think I really was drawn to the mission of what she was building more so than I was really keen to be writing and reporting. I just knew that I wanted to be a part of building an alternative to what I was seeing.
One of the ways I interpret the work of the Free Press is you want to present the information, but not tell me what to think. And you've written a lot of stories that I would think are very deeply personal. Mm. How do you separate that, what your personal feelings are, like your story about Columbia and anti-Semitism, versus how that internally makes you feel and your reactions to what's going on in the world around you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, especially when I'm writing about something personal, like you said, like anti-Semitism on campus, which was, like, a huge part of what I was experiencing and why I wanted to leave and join the Free Press. For me, it's like the medium is the message. It's like the vehicle is the news story. And so for me, I actually am really, I try quite hard to remove myself a little bit, because at the beginning, it was actually quite hard for me. It was really emotional. And my job is actually to not be emotional and to be really sound. And it was almost, like, cathartic in a way to be writing about it from a removed position where I was no longer living it. And I think it's helped me in my reporting because I have a very deep understanding of the way things work there. But I think I've gotten better and better with each story about pretending I didn't go there for a second, because like you said, it is deeply personal, but it does, I think, motivate me to deliver the best story, because of course I can't like completely be unbiased and remove myself. And I think there's a difference, frankly, between being unbiased and having a moral center. I don't think it's biased for me to say that the people screaming, you know, globalize the intifada should be challenged. For me, that is more about having a moral backbone than about being politically motivated, to be honest.
Does your attempt or your work to be presenting the facts, has that at all changed your perspective on those facts? That if you're trying to actively remove your emotion from the interpretation of the facts, does that ever change the way you look at them, for better or worse, that it may confirm your prior thought or undermine it?
Yeah, I think when I was there, when I was at Columbia and I was in it, I was really angry with like the institution itself. And it was like this ominous figure kind of. And in my reporting, something that's been really helpful to me is like institutions are just people. The people creating this culture are not, it's not faceless. Even people that I've criticized openly, like Columbia's old president, Katrina Armstrong. I criticized her for, you know, openly saying one thing to the Trump administration and another to her faculty members and board members. But at the end of the day, like, she's just a person, and I do not envy her position. And I make that really clear in my reporting, which is like, when she took this job, she was not expecting this. She was head of the medical school. Like, this is nowhere, she didn't want to be in the middle of a culture war. And so I think in reminding myself, these people are like me, they have the same human experiences, they get fevers, they go to work, they have friends, they sometimes feel fat, they like not Columbia mascots, has really helped me. And it doesn't necessarily mean I don't disagree with them or challenge them, but it actually has been helpful to understand who these actual people are and like how they all interact with each other. And a place like Columbia is very complex. There's a Senate, there's a board, there's faculty. It's a big place.
Time, have you ever felt any sort of hesitation in choosing to report, given the controversial conversations you cover?
Are there stories that I've wanted to shy away from? Or
yeah, have you ever just been hesitant to move forward, tell the story, because I could be getting in really deep trouble for this? I can receive a lot of backlash.
To me, those are the ones most worth doing. Like, I honestly sometimes have the opposite feeling, where I'm like, I wish this was maybe more complex or nuanced, and like there was more to say for me. I actually think what makes the Free Press special is like we're encouraged to kind of run towards those things, because usually those conversations, unpacking those, are like of the most service to the reader. There have been stories where like I'm overwhelmed by like the intricacy, or I don't understand the way something works. And not only is it makes me a better writer and reporter because I have to learn those things, if I don't understand it and I spend all my time trying to, how would an average reader who they just want to understand, like, should I send my kid to this place? Should I, whatever it is, like, I'm thinking about that person. And so for me, it's a fun intellectual assignment, but I think that's what makes the stories the most interesting.
My favorite writers has been Andrew Sullivan, has been very critical of the Free Press in a lot of ways. And I think at times even you specifically. How do you all as an institution and you personally handle criticism in a constructive way to either get better or ignore what you don't think is valid?
Yeah, I think that for the Free Press specifically, we have like a lot of critics. Some I frankly have to tune out completely. Because I don't view them as like criticizing in good faith. I think it's just like kind of nasty, and it's no longer like productive to engage. Someone like Andrew Sullivan is someone I've like looked up to and respected my whole life. That's someone that I try and like I read when he comments on things or when he writes about us, because it's important. Like, not everyone thinks the way that I do. And he's a really incredible thinker and writer. And so I think that engaging in that stuff can only make you better. And I think it's really easy to think, especially, you know, something he's quite critical of us on is Israel, our coverage of Israel. Like, it's naive and foolish for me to say that the protesters at Columbia, or really anywhere across the country, like that they're all naive and have no idea what they're talking about. That's a really intellectually lazy. Some of them have no idea what they're talking about, but a lot of them do. And so I think taking the people that deserve to be taken seriously only does a service to me, to my writing, to what I produce. So he is someone that I very much like respect and engage with.
Does reader feedback ever influence your subsequent stories, your coverage?
Well, I try and not read the comments as much as I used to. I'm very online, but I've never like left a comment on something. And you realize like the people leaving comments are usually the most emboldened and passionate. I do go through them and scan, but I try and not like, some of them can look like Reddit threads and it's like too much. The thing I do pay attention to is like the data of like, did people subscribe to the Free Press because of this story? Did they unsubscribe because of it? Are they bored of hearing about this thing? That's the thing that I care more about, is just like servicing who we're meant to be servicing. But the comments, like usually the meaner they are and the crazier they are, it's probably like the better the story was, frankly. So it's a little bit counterintuitive.
Yeah. It's an interesting way of thinking about it. When you're crafting your stories, are you ever thinking about not just the written word of them, but if you're presenting it, if you're talking on TV, if you're a part of a podcast, do you think about the way the story sounds, the tone, the rhythm of the story, the emotional resonance of the words? Is that a factor in how you go about your work?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the stuff that I write that's reported, which is most of what I write, is a recorded conversation with someone. So the first thing I do is like, you can read a transcript, but that's really not so helpful. So the first thing I do is, once I've had the conversation, collected my thoughts, when I'm with someone, I'll usually write down like the first word they said of a sentence that I know I want to return to. But the most time consuming thing is re-listening to transcripts, because there's so much information in the way someone speaks about something. Like, their words are one layer, but you know, if someone gets nervous, if they start stumbling, if they kind of avoid the question, that is all part of presenting the story fairly and accurately. And so I try as much as I can, if I'm quoting, you know, you, Eric, like Eric said with a X tone or face or voice. And it's why I honestly like interviewing people, ideally in person, if not on video, because you can kind of see and hear the way they're speaking more clearly. And then beyond like actual the sound of their voices, I think every story, yes, has like, it's about delivering information, but it also should be, in some cases, delightful to read. And so that's like the hardest, maybe most like artful part of it. And I think some stories maybe require that more than others. I think I'm thinking about that less in like a straight news story. I think a lot of it, and we have really amazing editors at the Free Press that help with this. I always want it to feel like a story someone doesn't want to put down.
And will you ever read out loud something you've written to try and hear what it sounds like?
Yeah, I was like a speech and debate kid. I very much feel like when you read something out loud, the best things sound like to read. The things that are the best to read sound natural when you say them out loud. So usually if you read something that trips you up, it's because it's not the way you speak. Plain English is usually the best writing. And so a lot of times I'll read before I file something, before I turn it in, I'll read it out loud. Maybe because there's like just too many words in a sentence. If I was saying that out loud to someone, I would feel like I've just jumbled my words. And also because there's like it's like a song, like some sentence should be longer and some should be shorter. But yes, I do find reading it out loud is quite helpful and forces me to be really succinct. Like if you can't say the idea or the thing in a sentence that like a fifth or sixth grader would get, it's not clear enough, in my opinion.
Do you feel for yourself, or any feedback you've gotten from subscribers, that there's a difference in how people absorb stories, if it's mainly visual, if it's mainly auditory, if it's a mix of both?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have like a couple of podcasts. We have Honestly, we have Conversations with Coleman, with Coleman Hughes. We have a few shows. And I think those are just like, a lot of the times there will be someone we want to interview and we think about like, what is the best venue for them? Is it a Q&A, a written Q&A? Is it a podcast conversation? Is it a video conversation? And I think, like I said before, like the medium is the message for a lot of these things. So we're always thinking about the right format for people, because yeah, sometimes like the person and what they have to say is the kind of the thing, rather than like whatever we put around it. And so we're always wanting to just deliver the message as clearly as possible.
Do you have a preferred medium? Because it seems like you've been doing more video lately, whether it's within the podcast realm or I forget exactly what you call it, but when there's some sort of breaking news and you're talking to experts in the area, that you've been doing more of that as well.
Yeah. A couple of the video, like live streams I've done have been around like news around the war. And for that kind of stuff, like I would prefer to just interview the expert and hear them off the cuff and in a timely way. Whereas,
have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Like, if I were to have recorded that conversation and then tried to parse through all those answers and write something, like, it probably wouldn't be that good. So for something like that, that's really timely and, like, people just want to log onto their phones and, like, understand what's happening, that's the best format for that. But I think in terms of, like, storytelling, I think writing is really the best format for me. Being on video is fun, and it's fun to interview interesting people, of course.
Is there anybody that's on your list of people you would want to interview?
Oh my God.
You've not had the opportunity yet.
Of course. I mean, I have like buckets. Lauren Weisberger wrote Devil Wears Prada. I want to interview her. Well, one, because like it's an amazing movie, but also because they're coming out with a sequel, and I started as Barry's assistant. And Barry was nowhere near, not even remotely close. She's an amazing boss, but it's like such a funny version. Okay, so that's one person. Political people, I want to interview Melania Trump. That will never probably happen because she doesn't give so many interviews. Those are probably like my top two right now. Susie Wiles, Trump's chief of staff. She's like a complete powerhouse. Those are kind of the people that are up there. For me,
one of the ideas that's come up in multiple podcasts, we've spoken with a bunch of musicians, and these days, as people have been more outspoken, and really in music, it's kind of happened throughout. But what do you think of the idea of separating artists from the art? And as you delve into controversial topics, do you find that you have the ability to separate the artist from the art when you might disagree with things they're saying or think they're saying things that are uninformed?
I mean, I think it's hard. Like, if their job is to say things that are informed, then I can't. Like, I don't think of a politician or a journalist as an artist. Most of the world, it's not their job to understand like the conflict in the Middle East or like whatever the news story is that day. For the people whose job it is, like, I hold them accountable to know what they're talking about, but I don't view them as an artist. I still, you know, like Kanye West, for instance, I still like his old music. It makes it harder for me to listen to because he wrote a song called Hail Hitler, but I think he is just incredibly mentally ill. Like, I don't think it does a service to anyone for me to like no longer listen to that music. I don't necessarily like play it in front of everyone, but there are people who really are like that, really protest those things. I don't think there's really a right answer. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, and I think it's a very personal topic in terms of how we internally react when we hear people out in the world who we respect the work they do, but we don't respect the things that they're saying.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I'm not going to not watch Woody Allen movies. Like, that doesn't, I don't know. It just doesn't.
So you feel like you can separate the art from the artist?
Yeah. When their job, his job is to make amazing movies. And he did that.
He's still doing his job.
Yeah. And like, do I disregard like all of the other things? Like, no, but I don't think it does anyone a profound service by, I'm trying to think if there's someone that's like really crossed a line that I really can't get behind. But to me, those people are not like musicians or I actually was talking with someone the other day about how a lot of musicians are obviously like within the Glastonbury, like the aftermath of all of this are like so anti-Israel. That artist at Glastonbury. But if I had liked that person, I could no longer listen to them because it was so. But I think the thing that offended me was that his job is just to play music and he made something that was supposed to be like joyous and fun, which is a music festival, into something political and kind of violent. And for me, that's where I'm like, stay in your lane. Mm-hmm. It's okay if you think it's not okay if you think that, you know, the IDF should all be dead. But if he was yelling free Palestine, like, okay, that's fine. But like, post that on your Instagram. Like, these people bought tickets to see you perform. And that's what bothers me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you feel like people ever size you up unfairly because they'll come across you and say, she's a reporter for the Free Press, and come up with all their preconceived notions before getting any further than that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, so much of my job is convincing people to talk to me that don't want to talk to me, which is hard. Like, people don't trust journalists generally, but also if they're like, if they are ideologically very opposed to me or to the Free Press, that's really hard. But I usually just try and say the honest truth, which is like, you can either not talk to me and reinforce all the things about us that you say are true, or you can voice your opinion to probably a group of people that are less inclined to agree with you. And like, that moves the needle more than you posting on your Instagram to your followers who probably mostly agree with you, whatever you're trying to get across. So usually trying to get those people to talk to me make for some of the best stories. But definitely people have, I'm always relieved, let's say, when I interview someone and they're like, I love the Free Press. It's like, great. That's like half the work's done.
Do you find those conversations where they're coming into it more hesitantly, or they may not want to talk to you, that at the end they say, or at the end of once you write about it, where they say, oh, you know what, that really was fair. I appreciate that we did that and it was a worthwhile time that we spent.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's also really been super rewarding for me. Like, I've spoken to Columbia professors or students or a lot of people that were really hesitant. And, you know, once they read the article, they're surprised. And I think that goes to show, I think there's like a caricature of everyone and everything online. And then there's like the real thing. Like I said before, I think they're probably thinking about the Free Press in the way that I used to think about Columbia, which is like this faceless, oh, these people entity. Just disagree with me, so they're going to like dunk on me. No, like my job is to just understand things as best I can and present them clearly. And so I really try and do that.
We've brought up the topic of AI with a number of people who have been on the podcast. Do you feel, and we feel it's going to interfere in a lot of different territories. Do you feel like it has the potential to interfere with your work or your of work?
I'm writing a story right now about this, not about writers, but about kids in college and high school who are choosing to not use it for no reason. They don't get a better grade or anything. They're just very opposed to it. Yes. The short answer is yes. It's really scary what this thing can do. And mostly for speed reasons. Like, I had something happen a few weeks ago where I was covering a court case. I was downtown in the courthouse. You can't bring in like your phone or computer. So you're like handwriting notes. And I was on like a tight deadline. And there were other reporters there. And I get out of the courthouse. I get my computer and phone back. I'm like, just go to a coffee shop nearby, not even back to the office, that I can like quickly type up my notes. And by the time I've typed my notes up, another reporter's story is up. And I'm like, I was beat. Like, how did that happen? And I was really, really pissed. Mm-hmm. And I realized, well, she probably took pictures of her notebook and it spit out a pretty straight news story that will take me like an hour or two to write. And that was really hard. But I think what makes the Free Press different is like, we don't really do just like straight news stories. We like have to do the sense making part of it, which is like, here's, you know, why you should care and what matters about this. But it can't replace, you can't outsource the thing that makes you human, which is thought. Writing to me is thinking. So I write something three or four or five or six times before I'm like, oh no, that's really what this story is about. And I can't outsource that. So that instance was hard for me because I was like feeling competitive and like I just kind of played myself by not using this, which didn't really cross my mind to. But the so much of like creating the best product, let's call it, is about the process of making it. And you can't, a chat bot cannot do that. A chat bot can't explain to a reader why they should care about something, but it's really hard. I mean, it's amazing what it can do. I'm sure you guys, yeah.
When I was asking the question before about the sound and rhythm and tone of a story, I'm thinking about like, if you're on Substack, you can play a reading of a story, but there's mm-hmm. no feeling, there's no tone behind
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, it's we have like an AI voice bot that sounds like yeah. me that reads my stories. We
it's
made
not the
that-
same.
No, we made that for the like senior subscribers that read it, that write in that like don't want to read it and the text too small, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But like I sometimes listen to it and I'm like, oh, like this is like not the same thing. Like it does not sound right.
Yeah, it's like Uncanny Valley sort of thing where it's close, but it's
nothing
off-putting.
Replaces the human.
Yeah. And I think the people that can lean into like what that thing is that makes them irreplaceable. And the thing that they're not able to outsource is like, will kind of define the next decade or so. It's been really, as I was saying, like reporting this story with these young kids about like not using it. It's been so interesting to hear really what motivates them because they're getting worse grades than their friends. And
I love hearing that some kids don't want to use it.
Yeah, they're amazing. I mean, they are, these like 16 and 17 year olds are basically saying, I don't want to give up the thing that like makes me and like I'm proud of the things that I produce that are mine that came from my brain or my heart or whatever it is. And so I do think like my generation is now very aware that like growing up on screens is really bad, and so I think there will be kind of this pendulum swing. But as I'm talking to these kids, it's a little bit like one of them said to me actually today that their friend who does use it says that like being curious and passionate is a privilege. And I don't have that like love of learning that you do. So, and school's like really hard for me. To me, like writing the essay is not this like inquisitive, deep process. It's like really painful and demoralizing. And so that made me feel like quite empathetic to the kid that is using AI to write their essays, because I think all of education needs a little bit of a shakeup. Because that's a lot of, that's the probably average experience is school being really hard and demoralizing. And then you have this, if you're a 16-year-old and there's this tool that can write your essay, it's like, yeah, you're going to use it. So like, yeah.
There's space out there for it.
Yeah. And switching gears a little bit, one of the questions we like asking on the podcast is when it comes to where you've gotten professionally, do you feel like there's somebody that's become a part of your story, or do you feel like you've become a part of somebody's story in a way that's been meaningful to you? The example that we give for us is like our patients that have cochlear implants, we get to become a part of their hearing journey and see them from maybe we're communicating pen and paper to you can have a conversation with somebody. Can you think of a time where either somebody's become a part of your story or you became a part of somebody's story?
That's a really good question. Probably one of the pieces I'm most proud of is about a number of Gen Z people leaving big cities and moving to towns you've never heard of. I mean, Noblesville, Indiana, to name one.
That was an interesting piece.
And it's really about like kind of how young people now just think about the good life and what they really want. And, you know, you see all these stats about young people not partying or being antisocial. And this tried to get at like, what are they running away from and what are they running towards? And a lot of the young people I spoke to were really, through my reporting process at first, were really hesitant about their decision. And they were like, I'm 24. And so it was fun for me to write because I really understood them. And that's not always the case. And they had said at the beginning, like, I don't know if I'm like missing out on parts of my 20s that only feel possible in a place like New York or LA or Chicago or Boston. I don't know if I'm, you know, depriving myself of a really formative experience for whatever reason. And like by the end of the reporting, they were like so sure of their decision because I'd asked them like all the questions. Like my job was just to really understand why they made the decision and how they felt about it. And I think by the end, they were very, especially when the article came out and they realized, oh, there was like six other people that also did this that are in another town. They felt very like kind of sure and settled. And that just made me so happy to hear from them later on. Like, you know, like I was so nervous about this move and this decision. And it felt so like one of them basically said to me, I had thought that the adventurous thing was to be in one of these big cities and doing the whole like When Harry Met Sally thing and, you know, that whole romanticized version. But I now realize like the adventurous thing is to move somewhere where I know absolutely no one and do what no other 20-year-olds are doing. And so for me, that was like a really nice moment that probably stands out to me the most.
My last question for you is, what is the dream that you would like to, what is the dream? Is there anywhere you would like to travel for reporting? Anything you would specifically like to cover? What is the absolute dream for you?
The absolute dream. That's a really big question.
Answer in whatever capacity you want.
Yeah. I mean, I love what I'm doing right now. I think like this story I'm writing now about these kids not using AI, a lot of people have really negative things to say about Gen Z and young people. And I think like the most fulfilling and impactful things that I'm writing and have written and want to continue to write are kind of like the white pill alternative to that. Like, I just think there's so much promise and optimism that should exist that really people don't feel. So I would like to continue to write stories kind of in that vein. People, you know, how many stories have you seen about the AI ruining the job markets? A lot. You probably haven't seen a lot of stories about young people going to trade school to become welders and mechanics and plumbers and all of these other things that are like reinvigorating small businesses. And yeah, like those things are happening. And I think to me, that's like what I'm most drawn to, at least in the near term.
And my last question for you is, when there is conflict in the newsroom, how do you resolve that? That if there's something, a story, an idea that you are passionate about and you're getting pushback and maybe there's disagreement, how is that ultimately resolved?
You know, it's so funny because it's a little bit like the Andrew Sullivan thing you brought up. And it's like everyone I work with, like I work with never Trumpers, I work with Trump voters, like it's a really wide range. But there is just a very like serious level of respect amongst everyone. And so if I want to do a story that my editor or someone else thinks is a bad idea, like I really listen to them and they really listen to me. And usually like we're both right in some way. And so that I've never worked in any other newsroom, but the people that have and then have come to the Free Press definitely say that that's kind of one of the first things they noticed, which was that it's very like conversational. And we debate the way stories are covered in meetings. And I think that shows in what we put out. There's a lot of brain power that goes towards just one story that's not just from the writer. And I think that makes us special.
Maya, thank you so much for coming on, for sharing your insights, your perspective.
Thank you, guys.
We've definitely enjoyed reading your work, hearing everything. So why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you, where they
yes.
can find your work and connect with you.
Yes. So you can subscribe to the Free Press at thefp.com and you can follow us on Instagram at the Free Press. I post my stories and all of our events and everything on Instagram, which is just my name, which is Maya Sulkin. But I really do encourage everyone to subscribe because it's worthwhile. It's worth your inbox
like
real estate.
$8 a month?
It's now 10.
10. Okay.
But you can start with a free subscription and
see if you like it.
Go from there.
Awesome. And we will link to all of those in the episode description. And Maya, thank you so much for coming on Hear Us Out.
Thank you.